Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Spectators Podcast. I'm Kate Andrews. If it hadn't been for the pandemic, the past year would have likely been dominated by a familiar topic, Brexit. The decision to leave, we're told, presents the UK with endless opportunity in a variety of sectors, including healthcare and life sciences. But it hasn't been the easiest year, with supply chains and the Northern Ireland Protocol already coming under strain. So, what are the opportunities to boost Britain's medical advancements now that it's left the EU? Where are the pitfalls? To discuss all this and more, I'm joined today by Antonis Papasolomantos, the Director of External Affairs for the biopharmaceutical company AbbVie, Global Health Editor for the Financial Times, Sarah Neville, and former Health Secretary, the Right Honourable Jeremy Hunt MP. This podcast is kindly sponsored by AbbVie. So Sarah, I'll start with you. Can you start by explaining why Brexit might allow us to do things differently when it comes to the healthcare sector?
Well, I think there's one very particular area where it might do, which is regulation. The MHRA, our national regulator, was previously an adjunct of the European Medicines Agency, to which we belonged through our membership of the European Union. But now we're no longer within the ambit of the EMA. And I think we're already seeing some quite intriguing signs of our regulator here starting to do things differently. It's always been one of the most admired, perhaps the most admired of all the national regulators. And what we've principally seen is how fleet of foot it can be. We saw it when the UK became the first country to authorise a COVID vaccine back at the end of the year, when we were still, of course, technically part of the European Union. But from the conversations I've had with people at the MHRA, they very much want to build on that. And they've already set out a new, they call it an innovative licensing and access pathway, which is enabling manufacturers of innovative medicines to get them on a fast track. It will bring into play things like the rolling review of data, which was what speeded the approval of the COVID vaccines. They typically, in the past, a company has waited until it's got all its data from all its clinical trials in before applying for approval. But that didn't happen with the COVID vaccine. The review was carried out at each stage as more data became available. They submitted it to the MHRA, which reviewed it. So when they got that final tranche of data, they were able to give a very quick decision. And I understand this is very much sort of what they see as the way of the future. And of course, if they can attract companies to manufacture their innovative medicines here, then that will go a long way to allaying fears that Britain will become less attractive for life sciences investment. Now we're no longer the gateway to that wider European market.
Antonis, innovation is key. Sarah was just speaking about it there, and it's also very important to AbbVie's work and what it involves. Perhaps you can illustrate the importance of it through an example of how life sciences innovation in the past has had a real impact on the lives of our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reflecting earlier around some of the areas that we work in, cancer, inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and things like that. And over the time that I've worked at AbbVie, it's a global pharmaceutical company, the time that I've worked here, the standards of care that have increased, the way in which we can now bring medicines to patients that control disease, allow them to go back to work, allow them potentially a almost curative type treatment in certain conditions where beforehand we didn't. And the exciting thing for me is seeing how that research at the moment is happening in the UK and elsewhere to raise the standards of care again in another decade's time. So we're really seeing more personalized treatments and treatments that can enable people to live a fuller life and suppress disease and control disease in a way that we couldn't do previously. And I think the exciting thing, just to pick up on some of the comments that Sarah was mentioning earlier around the opportunities that we have in the UK as the MHRA is a standalone regulator, for example, is how do we bring those innovations to UK patients earlier than perhaps we did before? So there's a lot of exciting things. I mean, the ILAP, the Innovative Licensing and Access Pathway, do shout at me if I use the acronyms. We love an acronym in our sector. But the ILAP pathway could enable us in the UK to take different decisions and attract globally trials into the UK and earlier licensing into the UK of medical innovations that are being researched at the moment. And I think that that's where our teams are really excited about the possibilities in the UK and how we might be able to harness some of the advantages that we have now.
Jeremy, you've said in the past that this is an area with some of the greatest potential. Do you think Britain's ability to capitalise on such innovations is stronger in or out of the EU?
Well, I think Brexit has always been something we can make a great success of if it becomes a catalyst to make us more hungry as a country. And if you look at the big global problem that Europe has, it is that we are just much less hungry than either the United States or Asia. And countries that have hunger, whether it's Taiwan or Israel or Ireland when it became independent from the UK, tend to be more successful. So if Brexit becomes that catalyst, we can be successful. But I think the pandemic is going to turbocharge that. And I think there are two particular areas. I totally agree with what Antonis and Sarah have just said. But I think there's a couple of further things. First of all, the public now understand how powerful it is to link your scientific community to your healthcare system. When I was health secretary, it was like there were these two parallel tracks, our brilliant scientists and our brilliant doctors. And we always talked about the potential of marrying the two, but we didn't actually see it in practice happen as much as it might. Now I think people understand that. And the fact that dexamethasone was discovered here as a treatment for COVID, I think that's going to be very powerful. The second thing is the way that science is going to transform healthcare. To date has always been a very West Coast of America discussion. But I think now we're going to see some really extraordinary changes. And I think the thing that hasn't been talked about enough is the way genetic mapping has been a vital part of this country's response. And I think we should aim to be the first country in the world where every baby born on the NHS has his or her genome decoded and put onto their medical record as a standard thing within a decade. And that could be an incredibly exciting thing.
Antonis, we've seen remarkable scientific and medical advancement in the past year, as Jeremy notes. The vaccines are an obvious one, but treatments too. What lessons around investment, regulation, or red tape might we learn in the future?
Yeah, it's been really interesting, the pandemic bringing kind of to the fore, to dinner table conversation, things that in the past were only quite geeky things that people in my sector talked about. So the fact that you bring together the UK scientific base alongside the healthcare sector is now something which is more understood, as Jeremy was saying. The role of clinical trials, the way in which a medicine gets developed, that you have a big funnel at the top, you put a lot of different compounds into it, and then you try and see through trials and scientific evidence what comes out and what will have an effect on what you're trying to impact against. And there's been loads of things that we've been learning in real time over the pandemic, which I think we can embed and continue to take forward. So Sarah mentioned rolling review of data, for example, seeing if you can review data as it comes in and speed up the process of filing and ultimately getting those medicines in the patient's hands in future. So rolling data would be an example. The way in which we conduct trials in the UK is an example as well. So the way in which you can quickly recruit patients to clinical trials in NHS sites across the country to single kind of standards, single protocols. We've learned some really interesting lessons that I think if we can embed those into routine practice, that could speed up development of medicines in other areas as well. So there's a few things that I think the NHS has shown such agility. And if we can maintain some of those going forward, we might see the benefits in areas like rheumatoid arthritis, in other inflammatory conditions, in cancer, and other non-COVID conditions. So there's two or three areas in particular that we could take forward.
Sarah, you're nodding.
Yes, I was thinking about the really interesting work that Novartis, the big Swiss pharma company, is doing very much in collaboration with the NHS. It's got a large-scale trial of a cholesterol-lowering medicine called inclisiran, and doing a clinical trial for that kind of drug, a drug with a real mass application, tends to be hugely expensive because you do need to recruit an awful lot of people to a trial like that. And pharma companies have become increasingly reluctant to engage in those sort of in research into those kinds of drugs you know, partly because of the expense of the clinical trials. They've tended to focus in recent years much more on drugs for rare diseases. But of course, there's still an enormous need in areas like lowering cholesterol. And they've been able, through partnering with the NHS, to do this trial considerably more cheaply because, you know, Jeremy mentioned this vital sort of symbiosis between life sciences and NHS records in this case that's allowed them to very quickly identify promising patients for this trial. And almost certainly they'll wind up doing a sort of commercial deal ultimately with the NHS, assuming this drug proves itself in the trials, to get it to British patients. So there's a real sort of virtuous circle there, I think, using the UK for these large scale trials, and then that ultimately going on to benefit British patients who may even get access to this drug ahead of patients elsewhere in the world as a result.
Jeremy, we're talking about some really innovative measures here that could possibly have a drastic improvement on the quality of life and quantity of years that we all get to live. But one of the criticisms that's been levied at the Brexit camp and at the Conservative Party is that decisions that have been made over the past few years have put the UK in a position where the NHS may be up for sale, parts of it may be sold off, that we're going to get more private companies and private investment involved. Our conversations so far would suggest that after Brexit there is going to be more collaboration between the public and private sector. How do you sell that to the public?
Well, I think the problem is that privatisation is a word that's used very lazily. In the public's mind, privatisation is sort of what happened when we were telling Sid about the privatisation of British Gas or BT. And we are never, and there's never been any plans to sell shares in hospitals, for example, or parts of the NHS. But what there has always been under both Labour and Conservative governments is sensible outsourcing to the private sector where they can do things more effectively than the NHS. And I think that it's very important that we maintain an open mind. If we want the NHS to offer the safest and highest quality care, then we have got to collaborate with the best in the world, whether they are from another country, whether they have a different ownership structure. I think there's a huge amount we can learn, for example, about the surgery techniques of Apollo in India. I think there's a very impressive prevention work that's done by not-for-profit organisations like Kaiser Permanente in the US. And learning and collaborating with those organisations doesn't mean that we change the ownership structure of the NHS. It just means that we get to work with people who can teach us very important things.
Sarah, problems have emerged with the Brexit deal, especially around the Northern Ireland Protocol. And you've reported recently about the extra red tape suppliers in Northern Ireland are facing, with some even claiming to have not launched new treatments for epilepsy, diabetes, and cancer because of the lack of mutual recognition of medicines between the UK and the EU after Brexit. That sounds very problematic.
It is, and I think it's one of the real curious aspects of the last couple of years, certainly within the industry. There's a strong feeling that this mutual recognition of licensing and of testing of drugs is something that could have been agreed very uncontentiously. While we were a member of the European Union, a license for a medicine and safety inspections and testing for a medicine applied. If it had taken place in any of the member states, it applied everywhere. But now the UK is outside that system. But if we simply agreed a mutual recognition agreement to just say, let's stick with the status quo ante, let's go on recognising each other's licensing and inspections. But that hasn't happened. And as you rightly say, Kate, we're starting to really see the real world impact of that in Northern Ireland, which for the purposes of medicines regulation is treated as part of the EU under the Northern Ireland Protocol. And already, as you rightly said, we reported in the FT a few days ago, companies are starting to withdraw medicines from that market because they don't want to undertake the cost and complexity of repeating and duplicating testing and inspections and licensing. And, you know, as you also mentioned, they're even deciding not to launch new drugs there. So unless a mutual recognition agreement can be completed, even at this late stage, certainly on the UK side. I think ministers have very far from given up hope on that. They still hope to get that agreement. But if it doesn't happen, we could be looking at Northern Ireland becoming a country with a really significantly reduced range of medicines on offer to patients. So this is something that's happening in the real world now, within essentially 3 months of us formally leaving the European Union.
Antonis, AbbVie has operations in the UK and Ireland. Do pharmaceutical companies like yourself worry about the instability that this new phase of UK-EU relations can bring?
I would say it's complex, definitely. I've learned a lot through the Brexit process around the way in which medicines are supplied and the way in which they flow through different parts of the system. And it is really difficult to what Sarah was saying. You have a situation where you have two different jurisdictions managing the same program, basically. So we are going to have to find, hopefully, pragmatic solutions. It's easy for me to say because I don't have to make those decisions, but our interest would be finding a pragmatic solution to some of these issues so that we don't duplicate batch testing of medicines, so we don't duplicate licensing of medicines where possible, so that you can ensure that patients in Northern Ireland have access to the same medicines that patients in England, Scotland, Wales and other countries have at the same time. So we're working really, really hard across our different supply chains to make sure that we continue to supply the medicines in the same way, continue to have them licensed in the same way for the same patient populations. But it is difficult. It's one of those ones where if you lift the bonnet, you realise there's a lot of complexity underneath that. And we just need to work through it in what I hope will be a pragmatic way and find some pragmatic solutions to some of the challenges we're facing.
Jeremy, surely this is far from ideal. As we record, David Frost is in renewed talks with the EU about the Northern Ireland Protocol. Do you get the feeling that medicines may be an area that gets resolved?
Well, it's the most logical area to get resolved because it's in everyone's interest to do so. I actually think that the EU has just got to get out of its anti-UK mindset. There is so much anger in Brussels about Brexit. And I think there is a view among some people, but by no means everyone, that Brexit must be seen to fail. And for that to happen, the UK must pay a visible economic price in terms of higher barriers. And so the kind of things that would automatically be a given in trade discussions with a Japan or a Canada or even a China are resisted when it comes to the UK. And I think it's a very negative thing. And I think that what will happen, the more the EU does this, the more it will spur that hunger in the UK to prove them wrong. And ultimately, the more likely we are going to turn into a Taiwan or an Israel off the coast of Europe, which is precisely what they want the least. So I really think from the EU's point of view, this kind of approach is completely illogical.
Sarah, let's talk about another healthcare area impacted by Brexit, and that's people. I think it's fair to say when it comes to health staff, it's a tale of two workers now, skilled workers that will be much more easily meeting the requirements under the government's new immigration system. But the ending of free movement makes it significantly harder, and in many cases impossible, for people in the care sector to come work in the UK.
Yes, I think it's a hugely worrying situation. There's almost a slightly sort of elitist approach, not just in terms of healthcare staff, but also on the science side, where prominent scientists are going to be given visas. But there's a real issue around earlier stage researchers, technicians, you know, the people who very much do the work in the engine room that paves the way for breakthroughs. But I mean, the issue in terms of the NHS and social care workforce has, you know, has become particularly acute because the stress that staff have suffered during the pandemic means we're looking at, you know, seriously compounded issues of recruitment and retention. So if you combine that with the unusually high proportion of nurses in particular who normally come into the UK who are trained outside the UK, I think it's about 15% of all registered nurses, which is more than double the OECD average. So this really is an issue that's felt more acutely in the UK than elsewhere. And it also has quite an important political ramification, because Boris Johnson's government has really pinned its colours to the mast of two or three big manifesto pledges on healthcare, one of which is having 50,000 more nurses working in the system by the end of this parliament than at the start. So if Boris Johnson wants to keep his promises to those red wall voters, for whom health was a hugely important factor in their Conservative vote, then he's really going to have to address some of this.
Jeremy, won't this impact on our ability to be a global health leader, especially given the existing problems in social care, which have only been made worse by the pandemic?
Well, I think if there was two things that could turn what happened last year into another 1948 moment, 1948 being the year the NHS was founded, last year being the toughest year in the NHS's history. So I'm sort of asking myself, what are the big historic things that you could do now to make this a pivotal moment for the NHS? The first would be to sort out the social care system, because I think anyone who looks at the NHS realises very quickly that you won't be able to solve the challenges facing the NHS independently of the social care system, because modern healthcare, and I'm sure Antonis would agree with this, is about prevention rather than cure. And the social care system is where you help keep people healthy and well so they don't need hospital treatment. But the other thing is actually touching on what Sarah was talking about, which is the failure over very many years to do long-term workforce planning. I became very convinced that we needed more doctors and nurses in the NHS and set up five new medical schools and increase doctor and nurse training places by a quarter. But the truth is that these training places are negotiated by the Health Secretary and the Chancellor right at the end of spending reviews. They're never a priority for the Treasury because they want to keep costs down. And from the Department of Health's point of view, well, this is the number of doctors we're going to have in 8, 9 or 10 years' time. So it seems a long way away. But ultimately, if we don't deal with the workforce pressures in the NHS, we are going to end up spending a fortune on locum doctors and agency nurses. It's more than £6 billion a year at the moment. And that is incredibly wasteful.
Antonis, what's your take on the human capital side of Brexit? You've talked a lot about patient-led recoveries in the past. For example, that this is a much more personalised approach. Is that still possible with the implications of Brexit for the healthcare labour force?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I hear the concerns that both Sarah and Jeremy have talked about in terms of the NHS workforce. We absolutely need to have a sustainable workforce that is able to develop and meet the needs of patients, but also make sure that they have a healthy place to work themselves and don't suffer from burnout. A lot of the doctors and nurses that I've engaged with recently, one of the things that they found benefit from in our engagements with them is just helping them to maintain their scientific knowledge and clinical knowledge on some of the advances that are being made in medicine. So I think that it's really important to have a sustainable workforce. I also really do think that there are opportunities for the workforce in the NHS, even post-Brexit. I understand the concerns that Sarah and Jeremy have raised, and I think that we definitely have to have a sustainable NHS workforce, one which is able to meet the needs of patients and all of us when we access the NHS, but also one which is able to do that in a way which doesn't lead to burnout. They can't obviously continue at the pace that they've been continuing in recently through the pandemic. So it has to be sustainable. But I do think there are opportunities to develop new skills and the workforce of the future. We should be thinking through what are the skills and the needs for doctors and nurses and pharmacists and other staff in the NHS in 10 years from now. That might be genomic-led medicine, personalised medicine. That might be multi-clinical pathways all being delivered around holistically around a patient. So I think that the skills that we have now are not necessarily going to be the skills that we need in 10 years' time to keep pace with scientific advances. And I think that there are opportunities to, as we maintain a healthy workforce, to actually build in new skills for the next decade.
Jeremy, one of the many issues with capacity during the pandemic hasn't actually been the number of beds or the size of hospitals. It's been the workforce and this idea that there just haven't been enough workers to go around. We're now facing potentially millions of people being on much longer waiting lists than they otherwise would have been for non-COVID operations and treatments. And doesn't that come back to this idea that actually we need more people here in the UK working in the health force? Now, part of that can be incentives and recruitment domestically, but a lot of it may have to come from abroad. Should we just be making it as easy as possible for anybody with these qualifications to come here?
Well, in the short term, yes, but in the longer term, it seems wrong to be importing doctors, for example, from African countries that are trying to develop their own healthcare systems that are going to get paid better in the NHS, but actually could be doing very important work in their home countries. And I think richer countries should broadly be self-sufficient. They should be training the numbers and doctors and nurses that they need, because there's a global shortage of 2 million doctors, and we shouldn't be exacerbating the problem as a wealthier country. But the fundamental decision that we have to make, and it's a decision for the Treasury and the government, is to increase the capacity of our healthcare system. Even prior to the pandemic, we had pressures on our waiting lists. We have an ageing population. Last year was the first year in human history that we had more over 65s than under 5s across the world. And we are going to need to progressively expand the capacity of our health and social care systems to cope with that. And the most cost-effective way of doing that, the most structured way, is to be a bit Singaporean about this and say, you know, how many doctors are we going to need in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and are we training them up, and make sure we're doing it? And it's something the Treasury are very nervous about, because they think that there's still some people who think that the best way to constrain health spending is to constrain the number of doctors and nurses you train. In fact, the opposite is true. If you don't train enough, you end up paying through the nose, as we've talked about, for locum and agency doctors and nurses.
I believe that was the lobby bell, so Jeremy, we're going to have to let you go momentarily. I just want to ask one last question to the rest of you, and Jeremy, you can start very quickly. What are you most excited about in the next few years for British healthcare?
Well, what I'm excited about is that everyone is focusing on it, and the focus is on innovation and science. And I think this could lead to radically different ways of thinking about things. If you take a perennial problem that has the NHS has wrestled with, which is that our cancer survival rates are worse than France or Germany's. Now, traditionally, people have looked at this and said, well, we need more early diagnosis, we need more access to some of the medicines, and we need better diagnostic kit and so on. All those things have a role, but there may also be a role for science and all the new therapies that are coming forward, where we can actually leapfrog other countries just by being quicker at embracing the very newest techniques. And so I think that makes this the most exciting sector to be in, both ethically, morally, after we've seen the amazing work that health workers have done in the pandemic, but also economically, because this is where we're going to have the most radical changes.
Sarah?
I think one of the most exciting things, actually, that we've now got is this huge laboratory network. You know, we came into the crisis with far too few labs. Of course, that was very much part of the early narrative about this country's failures during the beginning of the pandemic. We didn't have the testing capability, but now we do. And I think, you know, Jeremy, you were mentioning earlier, essentially moving to a more sort of prevention-based health service. It's been the holy grail for a very long time in the NHS, but we do now have the diagnostic infrastructure that we could potentially do much earlier testing, earlier diagnosis of conditions when they can be treated more cheaply, let alone, you know, considerably more pleasantly for the individuals concerned. So I think that's a real opportunity. I think the other one, which, you know, I've been astonished at the speed with which digital communications have started to transform not just GP appointments, but outpatient appointments. Increasingly, people are just no longer going into the hospital and waiting for an hour on a hard plastic chair in a waiting room to see a consultant for 10 minutes. They're doing it over a video screen. So I agree with Jeremy. I think there's lots of exciting things in the future, along with this really overwhelming challenge of the waiting times that we're going to be grappling with, you know, probably for the next 5 years or so.
Antonis?
Yeah, the couple of things that I might say is I agree that there needs to be capacity within the health system. But interestingly, is you can also have choices in terms of where that capacity is within the system. So there's opportunities to think a bit differently around where healthcare is delivered. And over the next decade or so, we need to be thinking about how we improve community-based care, for example, with an individual in a long-term condition. Are there opportunities through digital innovations, through more remote-based appointments, and through the kind of embracing innovation, that we could actually change some of the patient pathways a little bit so an individual is able to access care in a completely different way than they have done traditionally? And I think where we place our capacity within the health system will make us more resilient to absorbing pandemics. Hopefully there won't be another one like this, but pandemics in the future, I think that's important. And then the second thing I'd say is that there are opportunities with the UK charting its own course now to think about the way in which it wants to join up its pathway, all the way from clinical trials and basic research through to manufacturing, scale up, and then adoption of innovation. It's within the UK's gift more than it has been previously to join up that pathway from start to finish and think about the role that innovation and new treatments have in treating diseases and improving health outcomes. So I'd like to see that taken advantage of.
Sarah, Jeremy, Antonis, thank you for joining me.